Christmas Sunday. This is the one church. You never know what you're going to hear on Christmas Sunday. All of the churches, people go to church twice a year, Easter and Christmas, so they can hear the same message. You never know what I'm going to do. Neither do I. There are times I'm not even sure God does. But He seems to work it out. I am not going to Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, where the gospel record of the birth of Christ is told. I'm going to the Old Testament, first book, Genesis 28. That's easy. In the front of the book. I have a church, thank God, most of whom are heathen in the process of being saved. And I have to steer you about this book. Right in front. Genesis, beginnings, 28. If you were to go to Westminster Abbey, the tour guides would take you around. And included in the tour will be the coronation chair. And underneath the coronation chair, an old rock with a big crack in it. And they will recite, as they give you the tour, what they most probably do not believe. That you are looking at this incongruous, ugly rock of a substance not found in the British Isles, resting underneath this fancy centuries-old coronation chair. And they will refer to it, as I've said, probably not believing it, as Jacob's pillar. Yet, during the Second World War, those in authority in England knew that if they lost everything else to Hitler's armies, this old rock was the symbol giving glue in the minds of the people, holding the kingdom together. You that have seen Raiders of the Lost Ark need to know that there is a solid historic basis for the theme underlying that movie, Adolf Hitler's passion for religious symbols. And they knew that he wanted that rock. So they hid it, sent documents to Canada, kept in trust and in secret, that just in case England fell, and in later years, the tide turned and England was restored, these documents could guide men to where that stone was buried, and they could bring it out again, because on that rock the kings of England have been crowned since the Stuarts conquered Scotland. And before that, up until the time that Fergus conquered Ireland, the kings of Scotland were crowned on that rock, because Fergus knew, as the Stuarts knew when they took it from Scotland, that the allegiance of the people, and in Fergus's case, the allegiance of Ireland, was dependent upon the king being crowned upon that rock. As all the kings of Israel had been crowned, you often find the reference, they stood the king on a pillar. Not just any old pillar, on this particular rock. How did it get to Ireland? And I'll not even waste time today, though it'd be interesting, a lot more interesting than some of the stuff that's told on Christmas Sunday. Jeremiah took it there, along with a daughter of Zedekiah carrying in her veins the blood of David to fulfill the promise that as long as there was a sun in the heavens and a moon in the sky, a descendant of David through Solomon would sit on a throne somewhere ruling over Israel. Zedekiah was of the line of David through Solomon, and when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem, he brought the sons of Zedekiah out, killed them in full view of Zedekiah, thinking that Babylonian law would also prevail in Palestine, where only the male could inherit, and thus thinking he was wiping out the Davidic line that glued the people of Israel together, slaying all the sons of Zedekiah. He then blinded Zedekiah and carried him to Babylon, where he too would die in chains. He didn't know that some women of a tribe in Israel many years earlier had come to Moses and asked the question, if all the male heirs are wiped out, can the female inherit? And the Deuteronomy code added the proviso that in the absence of male heirs, female heirs received all the inheritance rights. Zedekiah had daughters, also of the line of David through Solomon. These daughters were nieces of Jeremiah the prophet and became his ward. And within 5 years of Jeremiah's disappearance, with no record of his death, from the biblical record, he appears having stopped off in Spain with one of the daughters of Zedekiah to marry the Milesian king there. He brings Tiatephai to Ireland and marries him to the high king, or her to the high king of Ireland, exacting the dowry that the center place would be Tara, and no vowels in the Hebrew language. That's a recent addition. Tara could just as easily be Torah. And it became the centerpiece of the government of Ireland, and Jeremiah himself wrote the laws of the land that became the basis of the common law in England and this nation of law, the United States of America. Tiatephai joined to the High King of Ireland, also witnessed the High King of Ireland being crowned on that stone that had been used to crown and give authority to the various kings of Israel down through their history. The High King of Ireland was crowned over that stone, and I gave the history in reverse. I'll now just say it succinctly, and that's why the stone, in order to get the allegiance of the Irish people, Fergus knew he must take it with him to Scotland, and the Stuarts, when they conquered Scotland, must take it to England, and it rests there today in Westminster Abbey. So why Jacob's pillar? You trace the history of that stone, you find that when Jacob gave the birthright to his sons, not only did he divide the birthright that had been passed from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob and give to the sons of Joseph all of those promised elements, reserving to Judah, who became the chief tribe of the Judah nation, the southern kingdom, after they divided at the death of Solomon. He gave to Judah the dominant tribe of that southern kingdom from which the name Jew comes. And you never encounter the name Jew until the kingdom separated after Solomon's death and the northern tribes, Israel, joined with Syria and are at war with the southern king Judah. And for the first time, the phrase or word Jew is used to describe the Judahites or the citizens of the southern kingdom dominated by Judah. When Jacob gave his blessings, he gave to Judah the right to rule, the scepter, and the right to make the laws. He gave to Joseph's sons, primarily Ephraim, the other birthright elements. That's even attested to in Chronicles. When you read in the Old Testament, there's two sets of records of the same historic period. 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles. 1st and 2nd Kings has those long passages about the prophets Elijah and Elisha. Because 1st and 2nd Kings is the chronicle of that time span of the kings during the period that they broke into two nations. And 1st and 2nd Kings is the chronicle of the northern nation, where Elijah and Elisha occupied their time. 1st and 2nd Chronicles is the record prepared and written down by the scribes of the southern kingdom. And even in that southern kingdom record, the record of the kingdom of Judah, 5th chapter, they recognize the scepter is Judah's, the right to make the law, but the birthright, Joseph's. Among other things that Jacob did, lest you think I've left that rock, among other things that Jacob did, he gave to the sons of Joseph, to whom the birthright came, what he called the shepherd's stone. And they would attend it. And as they come in Joshua 19 into the promised land, having been led out of Egypt by Moses, and in Joshua 19 the tribal lots are divided in the land, and each tribe is given their allotment. Again and again you find a bench marker stone mentioned at the corner of the border of the tribal lot of Ephraim, the son of Joseph. This benchmarker stone becomes the definitive point from which they measure out the lots. This shepherd stone has to move back further because Jacob gave it to Joseph's sons. And that's why they call it Jacob's pillar. And I come to the passage of today's lesson in Genesis. They call it Jacob's pillar because it first became important the night he fled, having deceived his blind father Isaac, deceived his brother Esau, the firstborn, and with his mother plotted to get the blessing that God would have given him anyway without his plotting. But he deceived old blind Isaac in the chapters that precede the verses I'm going to camp on today. Covered himself with skins because Esau was hairy. Baked a stew that Esau was prone to bake for his father. And you all know who've gone to Sunday school that even earlier than that, Jacob had found poor old Esau, the firstborn, out hungry hunting. And he had fixed a wonderful porridge. And when Esau smelled it, he said, "I can't live if I don't have a bite." And he asked Jacob to give him some, and Jacob's name means heel catcher, conniver, self-server. He came out of the womb grabbing his brother's heel, and they named him Jacob Heel Catcher. And he said, "I'll give you some soup." Kind brotherhood. Four starving brothers saying, "Give me a bite of your soup," and he says, "I'll give you some soup if you give me your birthright." The New Testament condemns Esau, saying, "Be not like that profane person, Esau," the Greek word meaning not discerning the true nature of spiritual things. And Esau just flipped it off, said, "Sure, you can have the birthright. Give me the soup." But when it came time for the blessing to come from Isaac, Esau wanted it back. And Jacob, while Esau was out hunting to prepare the stew to get his father's blessing, Jacob and his mother deceived old blind Isaac, and they got the blessing. And when Esau came in and began to scream and lament, Isaac said, "What I have done is done." And Jacob has the blessing, and Esau wants to kill him, and Jacob flees away. And as he flees, he comes to a place that gives us the basis for this remarkable stone that I've traced with 70-league boots through the path of history. He's tired. He's got a troubled conscience. He's lonely. And he lays down to sleep with a hard pillow. Not a very good night. Jacob went out from Beersheba. Verse 10. Am I boring you? And went toward Haran. Haran means halting. Abraham made the trip the other direction. Remember, he left Ur of the Chaldees, but didn't make a complete commitment to what God told him to do, which was separate from his country, separate from his kinfolk. He separated from his country, but he took his kinfolk, and he didn't make it to the promised land for a long time. He stopped at a place called Haran, which means halting. Now, Jacob is going back to that land of his ancestors, some of the relatives still living there, in the place that Abraham had camped until his father died. And he leaves Beersheba, went toward Haran. And he lighted upon a certain place and tarried there all night because the sun was set. And I'll tell you the place he lighted on. If you look at a modern map, it's Nablus. No more unattractive place can you find, and no less spiritual in appearance than that little dirty town of Nablus. And at the time that Jacob arrived there, it was called Luz, just a rocky spot between a couple of rocky hills in the uplands of Samaria. He tired, and he lighted on this place, and tarried there all night because the sun was set. And he took of the stones of that place and put them for his pillows and laid down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed. How many of you growing up in Sunday school, because it's a part of every Sunday school curriculum, have seen those pictures and looked at the quarterlies and been taught about that ladder from heaven where angels descended and ascended and came down to Jacob with his head on a rock? That's the passage we're in. He dreamed. I want you to understand, you don't have to be super mystical to go with this story. Some call it a vision. I like what the King James does here. He just had a dream. Tired, lonely, exhausted, troubled in conscience, separated from family, knowing he had done wrong, even though what he desired was right, he goes to sleep troubled. And he has a dream. I'm sure the food he ate before he went to sleep was not the best. I saw somebody yesterday, you know, we do fool things here at Christmas time. Saw somebody yesterday, had a headache. They'd eaten a whole pumpkin pie. A perfectly intelligent person, too. How many of you have been dumb like that through these holidays? Well, look out. God might speak to you. I'm going to wake you up. He dreamed. He didn't float 40 feet off the ground. How many of you have seen the movie The Blues Brothers? I like that movie. James Brown singing, remember, and the choir's flipping and flopping. And suddenly the light bathes the church. John Belushi starts shaking in his jaws. And the light isolates on him. And he goes crazy. I want you to understand that this was not that kind of visionary epiphany. He just had a dream. Quit making things so super spiritual. He just had a dream. You could have woke up the next morning, looked at a fellow sheepherder and said, guess what I just dreamed? You had too much soup and lentils. Dismiss it. I really want you to catch this frame, because I will fail in the message I'm going to try to communicate today if I don't pull us out of this super spiritual tendency. That to get a word from the Lord, you got to have bright lights go off, hot flashes up and down your body, some force shake you from toe to head, and strange guttural sounds start emanating from all around you. A halo descends. And the voice says, thou. Well, I'm in a hurry today. I got a lot to cover. There are people that are constantly looking for a spiritual experience. He had a dream with his head on a hard rock. That's what I said. He lighted upon a certain place, and he dreamed. And behold, a ladder set upon the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham thy father, and the God of Isaac. The land whereon thou liest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed. Thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth. Thou shalt spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north. Nothing new in that. Same promise that was given to Abraham and Isaac, now being reiterated. And to the south, and in thee and in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and will bring thee again into this land, for I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. And Jacob awaked out of his sleep, and he said, and I don't often use texts, that's not my style, but I'm using one today. Here's the text. And Jacob awaked out of his sleep, and he said, surely the Lord, you that have the King James when it's in capital letters, L-O-R-D, it's Yahweh, or Jehovah, surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. You know, the Hebrew has an interesting way of saying things. We would never say it this way in English. Never. The this. You never say it like that. What he's saying, and it gives a forces a pause in the Hebrew. Surely, Jehovah was in the place of the this. That's the literal. I mean, all of a sudden, this that sort of rolls by in the moments of time is grabbed hold of and frozen in place with that definite article. Surely the Lord was in the place of the this. Now it's different than just all the other thises. This place becomes the this, because the Lord is here, was there, still is here, and I knew it not. Again, the Hebrew, without taking too much time, has to do with awareness. Conscious awareness. I knew it not. Because intellectually, he knew God was everywhere. Now, I don't want to bog down on the jaw-breaking theological terms that none of us will ever be able to understand, explain, or even comprehend. But the age-old theological premise of the nature of God includes omnipresence. He's everywhere. A mystery. We don't know how to explain, but he's there, like the air around us. And what Jacob is saying is, all of a sudden, I'm recognizing not some creedal fact, not some intellectual knowledge that when I stop and think about, yeah, God is everywhere. Hoop-de-doo. How many, I doubt there's that many people in here that don't believe in God. So how many of you who believe in God that are in here, when you stop and think about it, you don't understand it, but you'll give voice to what you believe, God's everywhere. Hear him. Well, I'm going to weave a fabric and then pull it together. How many of you know the story of Daniel being called out as an old man, the fourth king that he served under in Babylon? When Belshazzar was mocking God the night before Cyrus conquered him, having diverted the waters of the Euphrates River and coming under the gates and bringing down the impregnable city of Babylon, the night that it happened, Belshazzar, successor to Nebuchadnezzar, is having a great party, mocking God, using in this drunken feast the vessels that had been stolen from the temple in Jerusalem. And suddenly in the middle of the party, God's a super party pooper when he wants to be. Suddenly in the middle of the party, a hand appears on the wall. Mene tekel, mene upharsin. Writing these strange words. And nobody can translate. And somebody remembers Daniel. And they bring Daniel in. You know the story. He concludes with this night. Thou art weighed in the balance and found wanting. This night thy soul is required of thee. And at that moment, Cyrus pierces the gates and Belshazzar's kingdom falls. But preceding that translation, preceding the indictment, Daniel's translation says, God, in whose hand thy breath is, and in whose hand thy ways are, hath weighed you in the balance, in his case, sad truth, and found one. You see, the reason I said earlier, don't get super mystical in this message, because I'm heading toward a conclusion. Don't separate from the normal activity of life an encounter with God that this story is recording. I don't want this message to be one of those super spiritual kind of experiences that is separated from life as we normally live it. He was a crooked, back to Jacob, crooked, lying, cheating, failing, miserable son of a... His mother was pretty low life too. And what they combined to do on old simple Isaac. He would not qualify for man of the year in spiritual halos. And he had a dream. Belshazzar's breath reeked with drunken debauchery. God is saying, in whose hand even thy drunken breath is held. They're going to take it from you tonight. Jacob, fleeing, cheating, lying, couldn't get away from the fact that God was there. You see, the church would have you believe you commit a little sin, God leaves you. The church would have you believe that you come every Sunday to hear that guy up there. And we ought to be suspicious, all of them now, after Jimmy Swagger. No, lift the fence legs. I'm not wearing joggers. Now, when some preacher comes in preaching perfectionism, you better say, heist up your pants. I want to see if you're wearing joggers. Chances are, if he is, the crotch is torn out, but don't have to go that high. And people right now during this Christmas season are in their once-a-year trek to meet God. They'll be glad when it's over. But Christmas is when they go to church to meet God. Christmas is the time of year that you see these talking idiots that when they lose. You ever seen them when they lose an idiot card? The news commentators. Some poor fool out there drops a card and you just see them blanch. They can't function without the idiot cards. This is the season when they get spiritual. Hanukkah, Christmas. Everybody finds God during December. He has rest of year off. He didn't have to be bothered with us. Christmas time, I can just see him up there. Will this month ever end? Eleven months of peace. Now comes December and they're bothering me the whole month. And you find God by taking on ecclesiastical tones. I should have said when I used that marvelous word a moment earlier, I don't use that word more than two or three messages a year, so 3 out of 52 weeks I ought to really sound spiritual, and I should have said, oh my presence. Goal. You can't get spiritual if you don't have those organ tones. You close your eyes. Drop the voice, and you talk to God. If I were God, I'd slap most people when they talk to me the way they talk. How would you like your husband to lay roll over in the bed at night after you've had, you know, a nice romantic dinner together and say, oh, dear. Talk about a turnoff. Can't you just see him going down the golden streets of heaven, talking to God? And I've said this before, I want the C&I dog franchise for heaven. Because they can't talk to God without having their eyes closed. So when they all get to heaven, since it's centered in God, we're going to have them wandering around. I want to see an eye dog. You got to be on your knees to talk to God. I remember a funny story about a preacher that fell in a hole on his head. Never prayed better in his life. Posture, tonality. Notice Jacob did not say, God visited me. He said, God was here. And I didn't know it. God was there in that Belshazzar feast. Belshazzar didn't know it. Moses, I've told you this before, Moses trying to deliver God's people and messing it up, feeling sorry for himself and fleeing Egypt, spent 40 years on the backside of the desert in training. He gets up one morning like any other morning of the 40 years and goes out to tend his father-in-law's sheep. And all of a sudden, this will blow your mind. He's looking at a bush there in the desert and it just incinerates. And it's burning, but it's not burning. And then he hears a voice. I told you this before. After 40 years of not hearing even a whisper from God, this voice out of the bush, God speaking, does not say, "Hey, you over there." It doesn't say, "Hey, shepherd." The first words come out of that bush, Moses. He knew his name. He knew exactly where he was. He was with him all the time. 40 years. Hadn't said a word. But he was there. Now, there are times that I preach a message. People take notes. You're going to hurt yourself taking notes today. No, I didn't mean what you thought I meant, Gil. There are times that the message goes ABC. Not today. You know I subscribe to the old German theory of learning, the Gestalt theory. Inadequately translated into English as field theory learning, where you hit people with a mass of information and you keep laying it on until an insight comes. And when suddenly insight hits you and you figure out, I got it. And the whole field then assembles. That's what I'm doing today. Walking around the subject until the insight hits, and then I can apply it as our year-end message for 1995. God was there. Moses didn't know it, just like Jacob. God didn't just visit that place. It didn't take God 40 years to find Moses. He was there all the time. And Moses is up trucking out with the sheep, just like any other day. But all of a sudden, just like this breakthrough, now, in Moses' case, kind of a super spiritual thing. Jacob's case, just a dream. But suddenly, the God who was there all the time, and Moses wasn't aware of it, spoke to him. God found him. God knew where he was. God never lost him. So that's wrong to say he found him. Isaiah once looked at a record of God's performance, as I keep throwing this stuff out. How much it is in reverse of the display case Christianity that is being trumpeted around the land today. Where any time you encounter a Christian program, they're showing God off. Isaiah, the greatest prophet of the Old Testament, concerning the suffering servant Messiah, whose message is so important to God, he made very sure that the modern Jewish nation gets his message, since the first century Pharisees missed it. Because as they've dug down into the stones by the Wailing Wall to uncover those original stones in the Temple of Solomon, and a cornerstone down there, they find a passage from Isaiah. Just like, pay attention. The Dead Sea Scrolls, dug up at Qumran, north of the Dead Sea. The most complete and perfect scroll, Isaiah. The magnitude of his prophecy is such that some scholars try to make it two Isaiahs. Just one. The year the king Uzziah died, no one else could see the Lord. He saw him. Sitting on a throne, high and lifted up. And God used Isaiah, comparable only to Moses and Jeremiah. But having cataloged God's performance in the people that God had chosen, he just steps back in one of his passages and blurts it out. Because God's so different than us, we like to show off. He steps back and says, truly thou art a God that hidest thyself. Your hand was there, I see it. You were steering all the time, I see it. But truly, I had to look for it, because thou art a God that hidest thyself. So throwing it out. Remember Elijah? I mean, he strode into King Ahab's court. I don't think he had any angel come and tell him this. Way back in Deuteronomy, God had said if they worshipped idols, he'd shut up the heavens and wouldn't let it rain anymore. They started worshipping idols long before Jeroboam's day. But in Jeroboam's day, they made it a national practice as the northern kingdom split off. And he said, it's too hard for you to go up to Jerusalem. Let me provide temples for you close at home. And he put images at Dan and Bethel, and they began to worship idols, and Jeroboam became known as the king who led them into sin. Well, they continued to worship idols until the days of wicked Ahab and Jezebel. Elijah's over in the desert, where if it didn't rain, it hurt him more than anybody. And the New Testament says he prayed earnestly that it wouldn't rain. That's a stupid prayer for a guy in the desert to pray. The only thing that makes sense of it is he had read God had said if they worship idols, he'd shut up the heaven, wouldn't let it rain. And God's honor meant more to Elijah than his own comfort. So he prayed that the promise of God's word would be kept, hung his body on it, which is true faith, walked into Ahab's court, said it ain't going to rain anymore. After he did that, God sent him to a brook that dried up, to a widow that didn't have anything. God can do things that we can't do. Well, I'm closer than anybody. Don't you know that no denomination would let God send a preacher to live with a widow on the backside of the desert? God sent Elijah to Zarephath. And he said, I've provided a widow there to feed you. Then when he got there, the widow didn't have anything. These are funny stories. I like the Bible. It's entertaining. Then he prayed in that conflict, remember, with the priests of Baal, and went up on Mount Carmel. And he said, today we're going to see who God is. And the Baal worshippers worship the sun in the sky, tracing back to Nimrod's days. And Elijah says, whichever God answers by fire, it's going to be God. So the Baal worshippers, as the sun came up, danced their jigs and put their sacrifice out and cut themselves. And when the sun got straight overhead, Elijah's tough. He mocks them. He says, "What's the matter with your God? You going to sleep or something?" The sun went down, no fire. Then Elijah decided to make it tough for God, for Jehovah. He said, "Dig a trench around the alder. Pour water on it." He got barrels of water poured on it. I still remember the first time I ever taught on this in my dad's church up in Oroville. It was one of those funny little women that came to his church. She always wore white. I can't think of her name right now. And I'm dramatically telling this story about him pouring the water on. And this little woman, squeaky voice, says, "Where'd you get the water? It hadn't rained in 7 years." The only time I ever wanted to kill a woman. But I thought quick. I said, "Carmel is right above Haifa Bay. Water out of the bay." He wasn't afraid of anything. Until Jezebel got on him. Jezebel said, "I'll have your head. And as these priests of Baal have been killed, you'll be killed." And he fled. Clear down, man, I've driven in a car the length of that land. He fled from Mount Carmel all the way south of the Dead Sea. In one long run, laid down under a juniper tree and wanted to die. And the scripture says God passed by and there was an earthquake and God wasn't in it. And there was fire and God wasn't in it. And there was wind and God wasn't in it. And then there was a still small voice. And God was in that voice that returned Elijah to simply acting in faith on what he knew God had said. The point I'm making is God was not in the spectacular. God was with him. God was with him on Mount Carmel where the fire came down. God was with him under the juniper tree where he wanted to commit suicide. And just as a little sidebar, since I've been preaching on grace these last several weeks, the only time God ever baked an angel or had an angel bake a cake for him was when he wanted to die. In his failure, God sent an angel to bake a cake for him. In his strength and in his success, God sent him to a brook that dried up and to a widow that didn't have anything. God's ways are not our ways. We'd have stomped on Elijah. God sent an angel to bake a cake for him. Got him back up on his feet. But God was with him everywhere. The point of this passage, Jacob, God was there in the this. Jacob, not aware. God's dream did not bring God there. God's dream, or the dream that Jacob had, brought to Jacob an awareness God was there all the time. I just didn't see him. I'm coming close to the conclusion now. He got up and it changed his life. He anointed the place with oil, and he anointed the rock. And he called it Bethel. Beth, Beyet, El. We translate it Beth, house of God, El. He anointed the place and gave it a designation. This is God's house. It looked like just a dusty bunch of weeds, brush, and rocks, and the pillow was hard. But this place is God's house. God lives here. He ain't gone anywhere. I didn't suddenly receive a visitation by God coming as a stranger to a strange place. This is not something unusual, as though God has been able to find this place because I led him here. This is God's house that I put my head on that just looked like a pile of rocks, dust, dirt, and brush. Then he did something else. He named the rock Bethel, house of God. Years later, God adopted the name, said, I'm talking to you another time. I am the God of Bethel. You recognize that that was my house and I was there, and I'm now talking to you as the God that you recognized and became aware of in that place. Now, you know, a people that would take a brazen serpent that Moses had raised in the wilderness during the Exodus and make such a religious relic out of it that Hezekiah had to lead a revival and call it Nehushtan, which sounds very glamorous in English, but simply translates a thing of brass, because the priest would bring this brazen serpent out and worship it rather than the God who had used it to focus on a truth and heal him. This is the greatest visitation that had occurred to Jacob and these people who preserved their relics. There's no way he'd leave that rock there. The place stayed and always came to be known as Bethel. The rock went with him. He kept that rock where his head lay the night that the God who later addressed himself to Jacob as, I am the God of Bethel, became a relic, carried down to Egypt, given by blessing to the sons of Joseph, Ephraim, carried through the wilderness as they exit out of Egypt. And I'm going to put a sidebar here and say, when there's 3.5 million people murmuring and complaining, and God says to Moses, tell them to assemble at the rock. They had marched to Rephidim, which means a place of rest. And there was a desert place, and they had no water, and they began to cry and murmur, and wanted to go back to Egypt, wanted to stone Moses. And God said, Moses, you assemble the people at the rock. The rock. What rock? The shepherd's stone. The rock that was the religious relic above all other relics up to that time. And they assembled at that rock. Moses struck it. Water pushed forth. Paul speaks of this rock. They all followed that same rock. And that rock was carried into Palestine. And I've already told you the history. It became the rock on which the kings were crowned, pointing back to its earliest designation, Bethel, house of God. And the kings were crowned on the house of God, recognizing that theirs was a stewardship from God eternal. That's the history of the rock. And they made it a symbol that I've traced in history. The point of today's message is, this was a fact before Jacob recognized it. But once he recognized that God was in the place of this ordinary, this night when I had a dream that I could explain away if I wanted to be cynical, this night that I could get up and say, oh, maybe so, maybe no. But he decided to go with it. And he made a commitment that changed his life. To live in the awareness. He made the first tithing commitment of his life there. And as he blessed his sons later in Egypt, he says, the God who kept the promise that I asked him of when I anointed that rock, and who has fed me and led me as a shepherd through all the days of my life. He now passes his blessing to his sons. It changed his life because what he was not aware of became a conscious, continuing awareness that God entered in to his fleeing moment, his loneliness, the disaster of the break with his family, and became the God who led him and fed him and guided him all his life's journey. Now, these past few months, I have preached again and again this same truth. I'm not preaching to people that don't have faith. If you're back in that level, come on Easter. I'll give you the basis of faith. But I remember after 3.5 years study of the resurrection, which was my hurdle stone. My dad had visions. I never even had dreams. But if I could believe that Christ came through that tomb, pierced that rock and that door, and sailed off, then molecular displacement without an explosion is nothing to him. I then have no difficulty believing that God will keep his promise flowing from that resurrection truth, I'll never leave you nor forsake you. I remember after 3.5 years of study, laying the last book down and saying, there is no other explanation. He came out of that tomb, so now what? And I sat there in a chair in an ordinary place, and I better start ordering my life as though he's alive and with me as he promised. I remember in those days, I bought an alarm watch in order to condition my mind to an awareness of another person. Nothing mystical. I'm not a mystical person. It took me a long time in physics to finally get in my mind that I think I'm pretty solid. But really, I'm not. What you see up here is mostly space and movement. Little bitty things going around in circles. And if you were an atom, you could shoot right through me and not hit anything. Or if you did, grab your parts and pray, because we'd blow up. But the biblical faith claims on the resurrection that this same God who brought forth Jesus from the tomb spoke, and nothing became everything, and he holds it together, and we move and have our being in him. And I said, oh, Gene better start acting like he's got another audience. Being a preacher's kid, I'd had another audience, but not one I liked. I mean, I grew up in the frame of reference. Well, I never wanted to be a preacher. All the kids of the church could do something. They said, the kids did this. If I were present, preacher's kid and the kids did this. I couldn't do anything. I told you I couldn't even play. I made varsity basketball as a freshman in high school. They wouldn't let me play because I was wearing shorts, as if my spindly legs would make the matron teachers go crazy. Everything was a sin. I mean, until I got free of that and got my eyes struck, man, I didn't even breathe. You could go to hell for breathing. I told you a few weeks ago. They made me go see Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs as a little kid, as part of a field trip. And I sat there and shook because my granddad had taught me if I go see a movie, I'm going to hell. That's why I'm so hard on these hypocrites. I grew up in that frame. It's a bunch of BS. Crap. Not what God's for. But that audience I'd kicked out a long time ago. I didn't care what they thought. I've said, for that audience, bury me with a tombstone that looks like the American Eagle stuck up in the air and put me upside down so they can kiss the part of me I want them to kiss rather easily. That audience doesn't matter. But once I settle the resurrection, there's another audience. I bought an alarm watch. Set it to go off every 30 minutes. Just to stop old Gene in his tracks. And say hello, mentally. I know somebody else is there. And let me tell you, all through the years, I've done as good as I'd like to do. If anybody thinks I don't care what that other audience thinks, you're real stupid. I'm still marching to that band. And I've spent a lifetime finding out to the best of my ability what he's for and against. I don't care what Jim Swagger thinks or those other jerks that can't even write their name in the original language. I care about his view. But what I lose ever so often in the stuff of life is I get like Jacob, I fail to understand that He's always there, and I keep wanting Him to break forth in an epiphany and say, "Hey, Gene, I'm here, it's okay." I'm saying at the close of 1995, and now here's my message, you could have done it in 5 minutes. You don't need a dream. You don't need a burning bush. God said it so many times. You just need to start returning to an understanding of His promises that we've been preaching here for 20 years. A few weeks ago, we talked about Nehemiah. David, at the peak of his ministry, about to lose it all in the revolt of Absalom, at least had the good sense to go to the Bible and the geography of the land in those days. He went to a place called Mahanaim, which means two hosts, two camps. Where did it originate? Same guy, Jacob. A few years later, Jacob, who had learned that wherever the this is, doesn't matter, doesn't have to be the prayer room of the local Episcopal church, it doesn't have to be on your knees with the card the Pope's going to bless, it doesn't have to be sitting down in Crystal Cathedral in one of their services where everybody's making it feel good, it doesn't have to be where a choir's singing. Even you, John, don't have to sing him down. Wherever you are. David had to go to a place called Mahanaim to remind him that Jacob had come to that place years ago, and facing the threat of Esau's armies, he gave voice, "Hey, there's another camp. There's my hosts, there's Esau's hosts, and there's the angelic host. And God is with me, that I recognized way back there when I anointed that rock." We preached on Romans 8. It's not true what the King James translates. All things work together for good to them that love God, to them that are called according to His purpose. That's not true. All things don't work together for good. But the literal translation is, God enters into all things to work His good to them that are called. Don't try to tell me some drunk who blindsides you in an intersection and put your loved one in a hospital, that drunk was part of God's plan. God turns freedom loose. That's why we have sin. But God is in the this of that emergency. It wasn't part of God's plan, buddy, to send you to Vietnam, saturate you with Agent Orange, and to put you in that veteran's hospital. Until I cried when I looked at you. But God entered in. Look at him now. Stand up, buddy. I wish I had a picture of the way he looked when he was there hanging. Everybody thought he was dead. Look at him now. It wasn't. It wasn't God's plan, Maiva. Put that infection in you. Praise God, you are here today. It cut into her twice. At 2 in the morning, 1 or 2, something like that, I called Buddy the next day because I was waked up troubled in my sleep for my Eva. We'd been praying. And in the hospital, she had called in. And I said, "How's my Eva? I was waked up last night praying for her. They were going to open her up a third time because they'd found another abscess. And they couldn't explain it as the white count, or the count of the white cells was out of control. But she's better. They couldn't find the abscess. It was gone. God didn't enter in. I mean, God didn't give her the infection, but God was there. Throughout this year, you watched your pastor, to my shame, want to run away and kick it out, preach as I went back to the foundation truths we have taught for 20 years and say, for 20 years I've preached these truths, I thought I would never have to need to grab these promises so desperately again. And I'll always love the congregation because you sat there and watched me for 8 months preach to myself. But I can stand here today and say, the this of the past year, which from my view was insanity, out of which no good of any kind could come. And God was on vacation, and like Thomas Carlyle, I wanted to say to him every week, you may be up there, but what in the hell are you doing? But I have now come to see that God had more sense than me. Marvelous revelation. I come to that periodically, but it's equally surprising every time. And I look back and see, yes, even this year, the this, and that's a good term, because I don't have any other word to describe it. The this of this past year, 1995 in my case, goes down as the banner year of Kabbalah. Now, you know, we have other languages that the FCC has not yet figured out what they mean. That's one of the words you're not supposed to use, Kabbalah. That's what a lot of you are going to leave when you go downstairs back there after this service. I want you to understand what it is I'm talking about. The this of 1995 is Kabbalah. How many had Kabbalah all year? This message is simply saying, God's there. The rest of the preachers will tell you He's only there in the anointing oil, the perfume, the olive oil, and the water, the host, and the wine. Maybe He's there in the wine, but I'm telling you He's there in the Kabbalah. That's the message. I told you I could have preached it in 5 minutes. This is a message for people I spent 20 years laying the bases of faith for. And it takes Kabbalah to test it. I'm saying God was there in the this, and He wasn't aware of it. Come on, get it out. Confession's good. I started. How many of you in 1995 thought God wasn't there? I got both hands up. I was sure I'd find Him in Anguilla. God be a fool to not be in Anguilla in February. He's everywhere. To those that are listening today in refugee camps in Liberia, huddled around stoves with limited supply of power in Armenia, risking their life in China. All I wanted to say in this message today is whatever the this is that's crushing you, you don't need a dream. You don't need a burning bush. God has already given that record dramatically. Go to Psalm 139. Whither shall I go from thy presence? Thou art there, wherever I go. I take the wings of the morning, dwell in the uttermost part of the sea. Thou art there. To make my bed in hell, Thou art there. No matter what, the this of your life, God is there. The incarnation, which is the basis of Christianity, He moved into the street where ordinary people live. Quit thinking you're only going to find God in a spiritual, acclimated atmosphere. It's where you are. I heard fools say, ask for you to go into this place. Would Jesus go there with you? Fool, He's already there. Ain't a bar in town. He's not there. He's just as much there as He is in the sanctuary. Just don't take so long to recognize it. And the God that I've been preaching for these last few weeks is there to enter in and work good in whatever your circumstance. the God we've been pulling out of this book is there for the prodigal, who when you start home, the father runs to kiss you and throw a feast. Whatever the this is that's crushing you, God's there and He's bigger than the this. So let's, in 1996, go in the knowledge, whatever the this is, for 1996, me and God can handle it. Because He's there before I ever get there. And that's my message for today. The place did not look like a place where God would be present, but God broke through in His case with a dream. God's there. Wherever. Otherwise, why are you fiddling around with this Christian faith, Hebrew faith? I've said for 20 years, if you're going to be a Christian, be one. You either don't need God at all, or worship the God that has revealed Himself, as we have seen in the message today. He's there. All the weeks of the year have been telling you what He wants to do for us. Know this, He's there to do it. Now the general offering is ready now. Come, ushers, it's offering time. I'll be talking to you all this week. For the year ahead, you want to say it together? We made it through 1996. Past tense. David had so much faith in one of his psalms, he put the future in the past tense. That's what we're doing. We made it through 1996. I go to the rock.